Again, we thank you for the opportunity to be here this evening, to come into your presence, to have fellowship in your word and fellowship with one another, and to hear the words that will help us know how to maintain a healthy relationship with you and also with one another, that we would learn how to communicate, how to forgive, and how to restore as much as we can the relationship you died on the cross to establish with us. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for the Spirit to unveil these things to us, and that we can hear and hear what the Spirit is speaking to us this evening. Lord, I pray this in your precious name. Amen.
What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder, relationship murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think the Scripture speaks to no purpose? He jealously desires the Spirit which he has made to dwell in us, but he gives a greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And when it says that God is opposed to the proud, what it means is that he sets himself against the proud. He works against the proud. He opposes the proud. But when it says he gives grace to the humble, it means that he is not opposing but helping, just the opposite. And some of the ways in which God gives grace to the humble, he gives it in the form of forgiveness, certainly justification, patience, help, empowerment, provision, protection, and other things of that nature. I want us to look at several scriptures regarding pride, because pride is a killer when it comes to conflict resolution. To whatever degree you allow pride to be part of your response when trying to resolve conflicts, that pride will get in the way. But to that same degree, God is going to be working against you. One of my thoughts early on in my life when I first came across this portion in James that God resists the proud is that the last thing I need is God's resistance. I already got enough problems in life. I don't need to add to them by adding that on top of the rest. But in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 5, just to reinforce how God sees the proud, everyone who is proud in heart, it says, is an abomination to the Lord. Or in other words, that's someone that God hates, abhors, loathes. And assuredly, he will not be unpunished. It's the first part of the verse that gives us a pretty clear picture of how God sees the proud. Luke chapter 18, Jesus is telling a parable. He's telling the parable of a Pharisee and a tax collector who both went up to the temple to pray. I'm sure you're well aware of this story. If you're not, you can read it for yourself. The Pharisee prayed a certain way, but here's how the tax collector prayed, and Jesus is commenting on the difference between pride and humility. But the tax collector, Jesus said, standing some distance away from the Pharisee, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I tell you, Jesus said, this man went to his home justified. So think about that word justified in terms of your theology. That's salvation. He went to his home saved, justified, humility. This man went to his home justified rather than the other. What is the first beatitude? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the humble, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then Jesus went on to say, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. Matthew chapter 23, verses 11 and 12. Again, Jesus is talking, and he says, but the greatest among you shall be your servant. In other words, if I can't serve, I have no business leading. The greatest among you shall be your servant. I grew up in a church where ultimately it was pretty important to have successful businessmen on the elder board. And at some point, I was not a successful businessman, but they ended up putting me on the elder board. I happened to be out of the meeting at the moment. I think I was using the bathroom. And they decided that I would be the chairman of the nominating committee. And when I came back in, they all chuckled as they told me my new job as an elder in the church. Well, we had our first meeting, and I said to the folks, you know, we can do what we've always done. There's this rotation system in our church. Every 3 years, you're on the elder board, and then you have a year off, and then you're on for 3 years, and then you have a year off. And there's this group of men that pass through the elder board. Said, we could do that. It's real simple. You know, take a couple meetings, we're all done. Or we could do something different this year. We could actually nominate someone who's spiritual. So people were kind of quiet, and I said, you know, I'm not going to push this on you. I'm just suggesting it. You go home for the next week. We would meet on Wednesday nights after prayer meeting. I said, you go home for the next week, think and pray about it, and come back, and this has to be a group decision. I'm not deciding this for us. So we got back together the next week, and it turned out everybody wanted to do that. So, what's that? Nominate somebody who's actually spiritual. Yes. Well, the word got out to the pastor that this is what we were doing, and he came to a subsequent meeting and tried to talk us out of this and wanted us to keep with the rotation. So I said to the folks, you know, this is your decision. Let's take another week, pray and think about this, and we'll come back the following week and decide what we're going to do. And we got back the following week, and everybody wanted to stay the course. Let's nominate somebody who's spiritual. And I'm telling you this story for only one reason. The gentleman that we nominated was probably the least in that church. He was a custodian in Southfield Public Schools, had no education beyond high school. He had never achieved anything greater than he missed so few days working. He was so faithful at work that when he retired, he had a year and a half of paid days for sick days that he'd accumulated all these years he worked. So we nominated him. He was put on the elder board, and he was truly the most spiritual individual in the church at that point. The least among you. Huh? And then Jesus went on to say what we've already read. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. Once again, Jesus is having a conversation, and it's with his disciples this time. This is in Luke chapter 22 and verse 27. For who is greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? And of course, the greater one, the more important one, is the one who's at the table. It's the servants who are the lesser. And Jesus affirms that this is the way we look at life. This is the natural way. The whole world looks at it this way. But then he says something that I think we should all take to heart. And he said, but I am among you as the one who serves. If anyone should have been served, it should have been Jesus Christ. And yet he came to serve. This is the mindset. This is the humble person's mindset that we desperately need when we go into conflict resolution. We are there to serve, not to win. We are there to serve, not to rule. We want to have that mindset. This takes us all the way back to where we started the first night, and that is with the idea that our security is in God and we can serve. Jesus could serve because his security was in God, not in man. It wasn't in his own hands, it was in God's hands. And yes, he was nailed to a cross. And from the world's perspective, he had been defeated, but from the eternal perspective of God and to our good, he brought salvation through what the world thought was defeat. Humbled himself. Colossians chapter 3, verses 12 to 14. I memorized this a number of years ago, and it took me a while before I realized that this list of character qualities that God wants us to have is a list. Everything on that list requires humility. And yes, humility is one of them. It's tucked right in the middle, interesting enough. I don't know if you ever noticed, this is an aside and an unnecessary one at that. But many of Paul's lists include five things. It's just an interesting observation of mine. He makes lists and often they include five things. But here in Colossians chapter 3, starting at verse 12, he says, so as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion. You have to see how evil you are yourself and how desperately you need compassion yourself, which takes humility in order to show compassion to others. Put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bearing with one another. How about that? And forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone. Just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. And beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. One of the things that I have been struck with is the number of people that I have met. Now, there may not be many more in the world. Maybe I've met all of them or most of them. But the number of people that I have met who can say, I know I'm a sinner, but if you ask them to name one sin that they are aware they committed, they can't answer. They don't really believe they're a sinner. They just know that that's what they're supposed to say. If you don't see yourself as a sinner who desperately needs forgiveness, how are you going to even grasp the idea of forgiving the people around you? And to see yourself as a sinner, to see yourself as you are, you have to have humility. You have to be humble. Moving on, submit therefore to God. Submitting to God when it is freely given. Yes, we might begin freely giving submission out of fear. Hopefully we'll end up freely giving submission out of love for God. But when submission is freely given, it is an act of humility. We humble ourselves in the presence of God. We humble ourselves in submission to God. And we bring that mindset into conflict resolution. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord and he will exalt you. I want to make a quick review just to remind you of a couple things from last week. Number one, communication is one of the most important factors in human relationships. It has many parts. Let me just run through this again, because as you are interacting with people, which you do every day, you should be aware of these things. People communicate by choice of words, tone of voice, how loud they speak, the emphasis that they put on certain words, talking in very hushed tones, facial expressions, hand gestures, body movements, and silence. Secondly, there's basically three types of communication: aggressive, passive, and good or godly communication. Aggressive communication is the use of strength or power to overwhelm, to intimidate, or manipulate others. It's a form of control. Passive communication is the use of gentle, pleasing, vague, intentionally appeasing language that avoids confrontation, argument, anger, and hostility. And passive communication looks very Christian because it gives the appearance of a very peaceful, agreeable, sweet, kind, and gracious person. And oftentimes, they want to make you believe that they approve of what you're doing or saying, and that they're cooperating with it, and that they're accepting it. Well, I can tell you for sure that one person who will not easily resolve conflict with you is the passive person. They'll stall that off, hopefully till their last breath, and then try to slip out of this world without having to deal with it. But they sure look nice in the process. Aggressive people and passive people want the same thing, and it's a very selfish thing. They want their own good. They're not seeking your good. They're not seeking the family good or the community good or the church good. They're seeking their own good at the expense of everyone else. Good communication is the use of honesty, respect, gentleness, gracious firmness when necessary, empathy, and impartial listening, in order to seek the good of everyone involved. Number three, we talked about I statements. I hope that you haven't forgotten them already. In fact, you were supposed to bring two with you. We'll give you a chance to share some of those in a few moments. But the I statements are a way of expressing your feelings, negative feelings included, your disappointments, your observations, your complaints about a person or his behavior, without attacking them directly or without condemning them directly. All right, there's two things that didn't make it into the book. I apologize for that. I thought of it this week. I think it was Tuesday. I was going back over the things we'd covered, and I realized I did not include these two things. So two suggestions not included in the book. One way to help others hear what you're saying is to preface or postscript what you want to say. For example, if I'm talking to somebody who I know is fairly passive and fairly anxious about acceptance and approval, and I'm going to say something to them that I'm thinking they're going to take as criticism, I can preface what I'm going to say like this. What I'm about to say to you is not a criticism. I am not seeking to criticize you. I'm not speaking against you. I'm just giving you this information in the hopes that you can do something with it. And then I tell them what I want to say. Now, if I don't preface, I can always postscript. When I get done with what I'm going to say, I can say, now, I just want to remind you, this is not a criticism. I am not here to criticize you. I'm not trying to just put you down or attack you. I'm just trying to let you know, here's how I see it, and can we talk about it? So that'd be an example of preface or postscript. If you're dealing with somebody who's really tense, you can preface and postscript. So keep that in mind when you're talking to people, especially people you know well enough that they're likely to need a preface or postscript. If I'm talking to somebody who I'm pretty sure is going to put up a fight, I can preface like this. I'm not looking for an argument. I'm not wanting to debate this with you. I just want to say this so you understand where I'm coming from. And then I can tell them. Another way to help people say what they want to say is to use empathy. Empathy helps people communicate to you, and that's beneficial because you need to hear what they have to say if you're going to understand them. For example, you might say, "It seems you have been deeply hurt, and I've added this by what I've done. My belief system is not my wife's, and we differ on this, so I'm going to admit that it's possible many of you won't buy into this idea either. This is just the way I look at life. I think it's better for me to make myself purposefully look bad, not in an exaggerated or deflective way, but just to open the door for you to say what you want to say to me. That's why I added in the parentheses by what I've done. It seems to me you've been deeply hurt by what I've done." When I add the what I've done, I find that most people are very free to open up and say, "Yeah, you're right. I was hurt. Here's what you did. Here's why it hurt me. But the thing is, I'm getting the information I need. This is helpful." So if I admit to them I'm this bad guy, then most often it helps them open up and tell me what they really want to tell me. Another form of empathy is, "Are you feeling hopeless about this?" Just asking a question. But a question that probably identifies where they are. Or, "Are you feeling like I don't care?" Gives them the opportunity to respond to that. Now, when you use empathy, you make a statement and you get quiet. Shut up. Don't say anything. Let them respond to it. If it takes a minute or 2 minutes, which is a long time in a conversation, just be quiet and let them respond to it. The last one, the example there is, "I understand why you feel the way you do." We use this very casually, which I don't encourage at all. If you don't understand, don't say it. Only say it if you really do understand. Now, understanding what a person is going through doesn't mean you have to go through the exact same thing. But if you've gone through something that's similar, that would create similar feelings or a similar experience, then you can at least identify to that degree. There are things that I have no ability to identify with because I've not experienced it. I would not say, "I understand why you feel the way you do," because that would be an outright lie. I don't understand the way you feel. So only use this if you really identify. But that helps people open up as well. All right. Questions or comments on those two things? Preface, postscript, empathy. Let's return to the homework then. I ask you to bring two I statements. If you're going to read yours, read them loud enough for all of us to hear. But I'd like to hear at least three or four I statements. Somebody read one, please. "I wish you wouldn't assume you know what I'm thinking." All right. What would you prefer? That you ask, or what would you like the person to do?
"I wish you would ask what I'm thinking or what."
Okay, rather than assuming, "I wish you would ask." Yes, yes. Good.
So you're not thinking of the effects part or the ideal part?
Not in that one. You don't have to.
You want that?
Oh, everything. What you wrote, I want what you wrote, yes.
Right.
So that would be a good example. By the way, there's an old statement, when we assume, I won't go through the rest of it, but when we assume and treat it as a fact, we are doing something that is irrational, illogical, nonsensical, and whatever other word you want to put on it. It is foolish. Always investigate. Find out if your assumptions are true. Don't treat your assumptions as fact. All right, somebody else with a nice statement?
It concerns me when you use anger, public humiliation, and state something as fact that isn't fact to get what you want. The facts are people are unnecessarily hurt, offended, shocked that a spiritual leader would use ungodly methods. This causes them to lose confidence in you and respect for you. I feel disappointed and sad that a spiritual leader would set such a poor example, and I'm concerned that this ultimately harms the overall spiritual health of the church and those under your leadership.
Okay.
And I prefer that you, as a spiritual leader, would model humility, be honest about your behavior, and have a willingness to put the spiritual health of the church above the way you want people to look up to you. And from this position, I'd like to sit down with you and work this out face to face.
Okay. One suggestion on that, I would leave out, I would only use the term spiritual leader 2 times, maybe, or 3 times at the most.
Right.
Limit its use. Because at some point it can feel like it's manipulative or hammering the person. Once you make that statement and clarify that that's how you see them, they know that's true the rest of the statement. So too many times becomes more of a manipulative, hammering kind of a... Yeah, that would be the only change. Otherwise, good. Thanks. Someone else?
When you feed the kitty more than she's supposed to eat and more than we agreed on, she throws up more, which means I have to clean up more. I prefer you feed her the right amount so I can spend less time cleaning.
All right. Thanks. Good. No, that's good. Why should we make more work for people? I agree with that. That's just not loving to make other people's lives more difficult. Anybody else? One more. Yeah, loud and clear, Gary.
When you don't call me back, I feel you don't care about me and don't want to talk with me. But some of these calls are important, and we need to talk to ourselves and sort of thing. I understand when life is busy. but you don't seem to answer any time. I'm hoping you can find a way by the end of the day, that way we can.
Yeah, good. A little avoidance there, huh? Yeah. Well, avoiding, you know, feels better for some people than facing the trauma of conflict resolution. Yes. All right. That was an exercise to get you to come up with a couple I statements, not just for my sake, but for your sake. If you can learn how to create them on the fly, you'll be better off. You don't have to use it exactly according to the formula, but if you know the formula, you can use it in ways that are helpful in many situations. So, I'm urging you, this is not just a one-time assignment. If you want to improve your communication, practice writing out I statements for a couple weeks. And I found in my own life that if I would write things out, what I wanted to say to somebody, be it an I statement or not, it would help me think it through more clearly, more carefully, and I got better at thinking on my feet. So writing out is a painful process sometimes. It may take away time from what you'd rather be doing in terms of having fun or getting a project done. But communication is pretty important, and this will help you the rest of your life, and that's why I'm promoting it. Let's move on to listening. Listening is just as important as talking. It is important to tell your side of the story. There is no doubt about it. But listening to the other person's side of the story is equally important. We've talked about this somewhat, but I want to make a reinforce this truth this evening. Listening is more than hearing words. It's more than showing you're paying attention by looking the person in the eye. And it's more than saying, several times along the way. Those aren't bad things to do. You should look at the person in the eye. You should face them when they're talking as much as possible. But listening is more than that. Listening is trying to understand how the other person sees a particular situation, how they're looking at it, how they have interpreted it. It's trying to understand how they feel about it. Not just how they see it, but how they feel about it as well, and why they see it the way they do, or why they feel about it the way they do. Listening includes understanding what they would like and why they want what they would like. Too often we hear the other person say something and we're shocked, or we think that's crazy, or we think they're just outlandish, they're excessive, but we have no idea of why they said what they said. If you get to the why, oftentimes it helps you understand why they said what they said, and it begins to have context. You can work with that. But once you simply decide the person is beyond help, or just crazy, or wanting something more than you're ever going to give, you've ended the conversation. So listening is trying to understand the hows and the whys and the whats of the other person. To discover those kind of things, the hows, the whats, and the whys, you need to listen to the speaker's choice of words. What words are they using? I'm guessing, and we've talked about red flag words, I'm guessing most of us are aware of at least some red flag words. If they're using red flag words, if they're using really strong language, if they're using profanity, that tells you something. It tells you something about how strongly they feel about it, how bothered they are, how upset or hurt they are. You could get all upset that they're using profanity, but better you understand why they're using the profanity. Because that's what you have to deal with, the why. Why they would go to that extent. It's understanding the feelings expressed by their words, and it's listening to understand what they're saying through their tone of voice and the volume that they're using. People put emphasis on certain words. People use choose certain words. People shout or get quiet at certain points in the storytelling. All these things give us information about what their side of the story is. And that's what listening includes. And it includes observing their body language. If they're poking their finger in your face, they're really intent on you understanding what they're saying at that moment. And most likely they want you to understand because they believe you got the problem. If they're just sitting back casually in their chair, legs crossed, looking relaxed, maybe they're in part of the story that doesn't matter that much, but you should still listen. Body language gives you a clue to what they're thinking, feeling, how they're seeing the situation. Once we think we understand what the other person is saying, then the next thing to do is to verify what we believe we've heard. And we do this with a method called reflecting back what you've heard. Not word for word. There's not enough time in the world for that. And you probably can't remember the word for word of what they said. Besides, that's pretty insincere. If you want to reflect back in a meaningful way, reflect the essence, the message of what they've said. What did you hear? What are they trying to communicate to you? That's what you reflect back. Here's what I heard you say. You are just tired of my being tardy, and it bothers you because then it makes you late, and you're just convinced that I don't care, that I like making you late, and what you want is for me to be on time. Now, the person could have told me a 10-minute story, but I would have just reflected back the essence of that story. Hopefully, I would have gotten their true feelings. You're just sick and tired of my being late. Reflecting back, the essence of the message is what is needed and what you ought to do. Now, listening to understand is best done when you begin to treat listening as what I call a fact-finding mission. You're on a mission, and the mission is to understand the other person. We've talked about this already. We're not listening to be able to come up with better arguments to defeat their argument, or to get them in a corner, or to get them to see it our way. We are on a fact-finding mission. Take yourself out of the fight. Take yourself out of the conflict for the moment and just listen to understand. I think of it as being a detective. You can't be a good detective if you are emotionally involved in the investigation. You have to calm your mind. You have to relax your emotions. You have to settle down, and you have to look and listen and investigate in order to see what's really there. The same is true with listening. So, you want to think of yourself as being on a fact-finding mission. And if you have that mindset, then you can listen a lot better, a lot less emotionally, a lot less defensively. And the goal is to, like I said, understand what the other person is saying. And part of reflecting back is not trying to put the person down or make the person realize that they've got a problem. You're simply reflecting the essence of their message in an unemotional, factual way.
Non-defensive.
Yes. Yes. So a couple things that you could say is, what I just heard you say is, or are you saying, and you lay it out, what do you think they've said? Or tell me more about, and then you say, here's what you said. Now, the reason to use the tell me more is because you need more information. But those would be three ways that you can begin reflecting back what the other person has said. So after reflecting back, you want to give the speaker the time they need to either agree or disagree with you. They're going to have to work this out in their own head. Is that what I really said? Is that what I really wanted to say? Did I come across that way? Do I really want to come across that way? They got to work this out. So give them the opportunity to work that out. It may take a few moments of silence while they, decide, I think you really got what I said, or you didn't get what I said. If you didn't get what they said, give them the opportunity to clarify. If in clarifying, you think they've changed their story, don't get upset about that. That's not an occasion to jump in and say, see, I knew it was your problem. No. Let them change their story. If they change their story, let them change their story and work with that. Because they may realize that they said something wrong, or they said something too strong, or they're upset about something that they really shouldn't be upset about in regard to that part of the story. Let them change their story. It's okay. What we want to do is get to a story we agree on. You're trying to understand the other person, and let them get to the story that you and they can agree is, this is my story. You've heard it right. Let's go with that. So, after you reflect, give them the opportunity to decide if you've heard it correctly or you haven't heard it correctly. If you haven't heard it correctly, give them the opportunity to tell you what the correct version of the story is. When you're telling your story and it's reflected back to you, you have the opportunity to correct it or to say, no, you know, I didn't really mean to say this. I didn't really mean to say that. I know I did. I was a little upset at the time. Let me try again. Start over again if you have to. Correct it. If they didn't hear you right, correct what they heard. Give them the chance to reflect it back again to make sure they heard it right this time. So, one of the important things is in this is that we don't turn reflecting into anything other than verifying the story. This is not about trapping people in their story. It's not about showing them that they can't be consistent or they're liars or they're whatever else. This is about simply verifying their story. Remember, listening needs to be fact-finding. You're on a mission.
That very last sentence up there says, you know, if they've changed, then show the inconsistency and give them the opportunity to share.
Right. So you can say, there's nothing wrong with saying, you said this first, now you're saying that. Let them do that. So, again, people aren't always, okay, let me back up a moment. The person telling the story isn't simply a storyteller. It's somebody who has emotions, feelings, fears, hopes, concerns about how you're hearing the story, concerns about how you're going to take the story. Right? So all of this is playing into their thought process, and they may say something, you reflect it back, they change it. My point is, let them change it. There's nothing wrong with saying, all right, you said this first, now you're saying that. Help me understand that. Give them a chance to clarify, especially if it's a significant change. But don't trap them in the first story. Let them change it. Give them that opportunity to change it. But it is fine to ask for clarification if you need that. Okay, does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. When you're listening to a story and somebody... Many people tend to be what I call nebulous or too general when they're telling their story. It really helps to be more specific. So, many times when a person tells their story to me, I'll ask for an example. Could you give me an example of what you mean? Or could you tell me the same thing in different words? What that does is it puts the person in the place of having to think what they just said, but say it with different words. It often becomes a lot more clear the second time around. Also, if the person is general, too general, and stays in that general pattern, ask them to be more specific. And asking for examples gives you that opportunity to encourage them to be more specific. There is nothing wrong with wanting to understand the story and needing more information to understand it. And there is something sad about our nature that we like to be so general, nebulous, unclear, and we think we're very clear. Clarity, the failure of clarity was exampled in the second week of this teaching, when I knew exactly what I meant and you didn't. And that happens when we communicate, when we tell our stories to each other. So, nothing wrong with saying, can you give me an example, or could you tell me that in different words? Could you say it in a different way? Ask for that. Now, some people have a long story. Don't interrupt too often, but if it gets going too far, say, could you stop? Can you remember where you are? If you have to take a note, just jot down a note. But let me see if I understand you to this point. Reflect back. Let them finish their story. I'm recommending you encourage them to try to remember where they were in the story, because people easily get distracted and then they can't remember where they were. It's hard for them to pick up. And you'll really mess up the process that way. But if you encourage them, you know, please remember where you are. If you need to take, write a note. But let me see if I understand you to this point. Because the story could go on for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. It's a long story, and to reflect that back is pretty challenging. So you can break up stories. It's okay to do that. Feel free to do that.
Can you ask them if it's okay if you take notes when they're telling a story?
Oh, yes, and I recommend taking notes. When the other person's telling their story, your job is to listen.
Yeah,
right. You may have questions, you may have disagreements, you may have whatever. You should have pencil and paper so you can jot notes down to go back to that topic, that issue, that point. Don't interrupt. Don't jump in. So use pencil and paper without a doubt. That's important.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
What about tape recording? It seems a lot of people are very skittish when you want to record.
Yeah, I don't recommend tape recording. Because it's too easy to use that against the person in a dishonest or unfair way. Editing or what have you. Keep the conversation between two people, unless you have a third party. You can take notes, but no, I don't recommend tape recording. If both parties ask for that and agree to that, and they really want that, that's another matter. But I don't suggest asking for it just alone. All right, this is the last point I want to make on this. Nobody has to agree with your story, and you don't have to agree with anybody else's story. This is not about buying their story. It's about understanding them. Know the difference. You have to deal with them. You don't have to agree that their story is accurate, true, reasonable, fair, right, but you do need to understand them. So we're not listening with any obligation to agree with them. And you don't have to say at the beginning, no, I'm not going to agree with anything you say. And you don't have to say halfway through, I don't believe a word you're saying. You just listen and try to understand their story. Then hopefully you can tell your story. And then you can go back and work out the differences. If your story is significantly different from theirs, and you can't make any headway, and you get a third party to help you, that third party will point out the discrepancies in the story, and that becomes a real helpful tool to work towards some agreement on what the real story is. So a third party is real helpful when two people have really different stories and they can't seem to find common ground. But you don't have to agree. And you don't have to tell the other person while they're telling their story that you don't agree. That's wrong. That's not right. How could you say that? Come on, I didn't do that. Zip your lip, listen to the story, understand what the person is saying. All right, last point on this listening part is I want to encourage you to listen to yourself. Practice listening to yourself. What do you sound like? What choice of words are you using? What is your tone of voice? What is the look on your face? What emphasis are you putting on certain words, and why is that emphasis? Listen to yourself. How impassioned are you, and should you be that impassioned? Maybe you should be, that's fine. But if you shouldn't be, you're hurting your own telling of the story. Listen to yourself. And in listening to yourself, try to get some understanding of how the other person is probably hearing you. If you're using profanity and the other person is a non-profanity person and they're offended by a profanity, then isn't it likely they're being offended in your storytelling? So are you helping the conflict or are you just adding to it? You're making it harder for them to hear what you're saying. Listen to yourself. If you're using exaggerations, you always do it. You never do it. What does that sound like to the other person? Listen to yourself. I urge you to get used to listening to yourself. Hear what you sound like. If you need help and you have a close friend or you're in a family, you have a parent or a sibling, or you have a spouse, ask somebody near and dear to you, what do I sound like? Or what did I just sound like? Find out how you're coming across.
Question.
Yes.
I've been advised by my wife and also my son that I should listen to myself. And so technically, how do you listen to yourself? I mean...
I'm glad you used the word technically, because technically you use your ears. So when you're talking, try to notice how you're coming across, what you sound like. I get in conversations. I've had a few conversations with your own son where I would, just because I'm passionate about the topic, I start revving up. And I realize as I'm listening to myself, I'm revving up, and I'm not just talking to him in this, you know, even-keeled, here's the real world kind of a way. So I remind myself to slow down, and right? But I have practiced listening to myself. One of the ways you could learn to listen to yourself is, let's say your wife or your children who have advised you to listen to yourself, let's say that they think you do certain things on a recurring basis. You could ask them to tell you when you do it. Now, you don't want them to interrupt the conversation, so you could come up with a signal. You could say, dear wife, tell me when I'm going to use this word, I don't mean you'd ever do that, but when I'm attacking you. And tell me by just holding up one finger while I'm talking. Just go like this, honey. Just do this. When I see that, I'm going to know you think I'm attacking you. Now, when that happens, it happens in real time. And you could potentially reflect back just seconds. What did I sound like? How was I coming across? And in that way, start to get in touch with what you do sound like. So getting help is helpful. Having somebody give you feedback about what you sound like. Other than that, you just have to practice listening to yourself. When I use these words, when I use this volume, when I put the emphasis on these words, when I say these things, you know, what am I sounding like? How am I coming across?
But there's a difference between speak carefully and slowly and listening to yourself, right? I still don't get, I understand you can get help from whoever you talk to, but exactly how people kind of be so aware of, almost like a third party can listen to yourself, and I'm just still a little bit not that clear.
So you may never be good at this. You know, I'll never be a great quarterback or a great writer, but I could get better. And you could too. So I don't know how good you'll ever become at listening to yourself. I recommend asking God to make you sensitive to what you sound like, helping you hear what you sound like, asking the people around you what you sound like, and when they tell you something, try listening for that. Listening for when you use that tone of voice, or just observing how, you know, what's coming out of your mouth, what the look on your face is, what your body language says.
John, you asked about tape recording earlier. Depending on the person, that can actually be pretty useful just in terms of listening to yourself.
Yeah, I'll think about that. I should. Please kind of talk about that.
Yes, but you'd want to tape record it for your own benefit and growth, not for hers. Yes. Yes, that would be good.
Go to the bathroom. And, I mean, if you have the opportunity, right afterwards, same way, and see what you look like.
Yeah, you could. Look in the mirror. Yes.
See if your brow is going up. Or...
If you observe other people, you can at least begin to imagine what you might be looking like or sounding like when you speak in a similar way. I wanted to get to the helping the other person communicate. Encourage you to read through that. I do want to do the role play because this is, I think, important for us. I handed out role plays already. Some of you have a partner. Who doesn't have a partner?
All right, read through your page so you have an idea of what you're supposed to do. This is a role play about church life. One person is the member of the finance committee, and the finance committee has chosen to give the pastor a raise. And the other person in this role play is a disgruntled church member who thinks the pastor doesn't deserve a raise. So the church member is the aggressive one. The more passive person is to be the finance committee member. And the goal is to use everything we've talked about and hopefully you've learned. If you aren't in a role play but want to observe, you can sit with somebody. We will give you at least 20 minutes to do this.
All right, folks. Let's get back together.
All right, what did you learn from this? Did anybody solve their issue?
We did.
We did. Yeah. Loud and clear. Go ahead. How'd you solve it? I see Elizabeth is gone, so she mustn't.
You just told her to leave the church, and it's all
right. That was a topic issue.
No, just kidding. I don't know what she added and what was in her paragraph, so what's uniform, but the idea was that at least she felt that she didn't know if she didn't feel as cared for by the pastor as the previous one. She didn't think the money was warranted. So it's kind of like, if you're serving us less, why should we pay you more? So we thought it was important to have a little bit of accountability between the leadership and the pastor, just to get an idea of how the pastor made their time and making sure it's the best use of the time. And I think that would make some of the members more comfortable. Additionally, we decided that there needs to be a little more communication between the finance committee and church members who actually made the offerings, you know, somehow.
All right, thank you. Did you want to add anything, Elizabeth?
I threw my book on the floor.
That helped, huh? Well, in my setting, it was interesting that both these settings came up with the same problem. The pastor was not spending appropriate time with the members and playing too much tennis. During work hours, yes. So that he didn't deserve that kind of a raise.
But our board member, our disgruntled guy, realized that the pastor was probably, hours were different. In the evenings, he could have been visiting people. And you were a worker, because his complaint, well, I work, and I don't get to play tennis during the day. But we came up with a similar solution that there could be more better communication, because if the thought was that the people could come sooner and ask questions and give their feelings about, you know, we feel the pastor's messages are too long, he's not visiting people, it might be something to look at and consider.
His messages are too long.
Yeah.
Wow. Can't imagine that.
Must have been talking about me.
All right, how many of you thought that the finance committee needed to have better communication with the whole church? All right, that's a good group of you. Okay, and that's a reasonable thing.
The board as a whole.
The board as a whole? Okay. I don't know how many of you came up with this, but in my situation, I was the passive member, and I offered for the more disgruntled church member to meet with the pastor and work out some of these things. Any of you do that? Okay, good. Good. Why is that good also? I'm not diminishing the financial committee's need for good communication with the whole church, but why the disgruntled church member and the pastor, get them together?
For their own building up and conflict resolutions.
Right, and that's also where the problem is, isn't it?
Issues.
Between those two, yes.
I was going to offer that, but the pastor played tennis too often.
Couldn't break away from the tennis to meet with the... Yes?
Well, doesn't the fact that the disgruntled church member went to the finance committee like indicate that they don't want to talk to the pastor?
That's the whole problem.
Well, that may be true, but that doesn't mean that can't be offered or it shouldn't be promoted. Well, if we go back to what Jesus taught, you're to go to your brother. And going to the committee is one step, and it certainly is a worthy step, but it's not the reconciliation step. Nothing is reconciled between the pastor and the disgruntled church member by going to the finance committee. That discussion essentially revolved around a raise or no raise. But the real reconciliation, in my opinion, needs to take place between the disgruntled member and the pastor.
Well, there would have been both, because the disgruntled member now has an issue with the finance committee.
Right.
So whether that was the original issue or not no longer matters, because they now have a conflict with the finance committee, because they're thinking, hey, this finance committee doesn't care about us as the members of the church.
That's
so
true.
That needed to be resolved as well. It wouldn't... It could possibly have been resolved by just going straight to the pastor, but not likely.
I don't know that going straight to the pastor was the right thing to do. Going to the finance committee was a good move. My point, and by going to the finance committee and having a representative there, they could hopefully reconcile the disgruntled member and the finance committee. Now, I happen to have a pretty cooperative disgruntled member who was only angry for part of the time. And this member was willing to reconcile with the finance committee and come to some terms and agreement about the raise. So, yes, I agree that that relationship needed reconciliation. I still would hold that the member and the pastor need to work out their differences, too. And there was a hand in the back. All right. Anybody else? Thoughts on this?
That's getting together with the pastor, and you said they would arrange to meet, like that person would act as a third party.
Well, in our situation, what was agreed upon is that I as the finance member would talk to the pastor, would seek out a recommended third party, unbiased third party mediator who was recommended by the disgruntled member, and bring the three of them together, the pastor, probably the family, not just the one person, but the family, the pastor, and this third party who would mediate. So I would take I took the responsibility to set that up. Does that answer your question? Now, the goal of this exercise is to give you practice. Practice helps you when you're in the real world keep your thoughts and head about you so that you slow down, you listen, and you try to understand the other side and see how far you can work through the issue. All right, homework, please. So the homework is on the overhead. Read pages 26 to 29 about right attitudes. And then fill in your own words on pages 30 and 31. That's not two full pages of fill-in, so don't be afraid of it, but hopefully it's thought-provoking. Help you think things through. Any other questions or comments? Let's pray together. Father God, you have given us your word, your Holy Spirit, an intellect, the body of Christ, people who have gone before, those who understand what we don't. You've given us your presence and power, your enablement. We have all these things. Teach us, Father, teach us to use all of them, all that you have given to us, to work out our differences with the people around us, to love them as we ought, to resolve our differences and reconcile our relationships. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.